Our first case for argument, United States v. Tolton and others. Ms. Jansen.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Margaret Jansen, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Gary Stevenson, who's serving a life sentence in federal penitentiary as the result of the trial in this case. Your Honors have the briefs before them, wherein we raised a couple of different issues, but for purposes of this argument, I'd just like to focus on the 404B argument, and I just have 2 points I'd like to make on that.
Who do you represent?
Mr. Stevenson, Your Honor, Mr. Gary Stevenson.
Okay.
And the 2 points are simply that the government introduced significant evidence of marijuana in a case where the only crime charged was cocaine, and at no point through today has the government ever offered a legitimate purpose that was served by that evidence. And secondly, the district court failed to exercise any discretion in allowing the marijuana evidence in at trial.
It was always coupled with cocaine, though, wasn't it? Other drugs?
There was heroin and there was,
It was always being discussed, marijuana and whatever else they were distributing.
That's true. And in most instances where it came up in the record, the marijuana evidence was being used for the same purposes as the cocaine and crack cocaine evidence was also coming in.
Isn't 404 aimed at for so-called propensity evidence? I don't see any indication that this kind of evidence had anything to do with propensity.
Well, at no point has the government ever challenged that this was 404B evidence. In fact, in their response...
I think it's very questionable whether this is covered by 404.
Well, it's hard to see, given the manner in which this evidence was introduced, what other purpose then was served by the marijuana evidence, given the fact
that... Well, it's that just part of it. You just asked a question about what happened, and he told him what happened. I mean, he sold two kinds of drugs.
Well, that is true, Your Honor. However,
are you saying it's irrelevant?
I'm not saying the evidence was irrelevant because I think it was unreasonable to think that the jury did not consider this evidence alongside the cocaine evidence when it reached its verdict. But I'm saying it's particularly problematic that the government introduced this over the course of a 3-day trial on every single day through 6 separate witnesses and then proceeded to argue it in their closing arguments in support of the cocaine conspiracy. And what's particularly troubling here is that the district court, when it was on notice that this evidence was coming in, failed to offer to conduct an analysis subject to 404B or render any kind of a finding in support of its ruling on this evidence. It never put the government to its task of showing what purpose was served by the marijuana evidence. As is required by the rule, nor did it limit its use in front of the jury.
What was the prejudice from this?
The prejudice was that the jury was allowed to consider the marijuana evidence.
But what would it add? It's a crack case. There's a lot of evidence of his selling crack. What difference would it make to a jury if there was also marijuana?
Well, I think marijuana evidence, if it serves no other purpose, it just impugns...
I understand, it has no purpose, but the question is what harm it did.
Well, it unnecessarily makes Mr. Stevenson look like a bad guy.
No. The crack cocaine evidence makes him look very bad, right? So what does the marijuana add?
Well,
makes him a little worse?
Well, if the crack cocaine evidence was enough to render the conviction, then it's hard to see why the government needed to use it, but apparently it thought it did.
Well, that issue arises in every harmless error case, right?
Well, the evidence came in over the course, you know, repeatedly through trial, and it was very intentionally introduced. And if it was simply an incidental occurrence, it's hard to see why the government then argued it in its closing. But in fact, it did.
But on what basis would the jury have acquitted the defendant if there hadn't been any marijuana evidence?
Well, I think it's hard to say, you know, post-factually on what basis, but I think it's very reasonable to say that they took it into consideration considering...
That's not a responsive answer. What would be the basis for their acquitting on if there were just crack cocaine evidence?
Well, it could go to any one of the elements that the government was required to prove with respect. Intent.
Intent? There's a question about intent?
Well, I think whenever you have cases where there's a lot of drug evidence that could potentially come in, all of those elements are at issue, which is why evidence of other bad acts usually does come in, but it has to come in subject to a proper showing. And no such showing was made here by the government.
Could I ask one unrelated question? Was venue an issue in your case?
Venue was not an issue in our case.
And Mr. Bohannon testified?
Yes, he did.
And did he testify that the drugs were fronted to him? I mean, the drugs were fronted?
I believe so, but I don't know. I'd have to check the briefs.
Okay. You didn't try the case, obviously. Right?
We did not. We were not trial counsel in this case.
Yeah. Why were the defendants tried separately?
Because it was a conspiracy, and I believe the government was concerned with issues of, you know, Sixth Amendment issues, but I don't know because I was...
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Jansen. Mr. Anderson?
May it please the Court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, representing Appellant Kenneth Chalton. Ms. Chalton was, of course, tried for the same conspiracy that Mr. Stevenson was, but in a separate trial. And in his trial, there was...
Separate trial?
I'm sorry, what?
Why were these separate trials?
The government made a motion for separate trials because they were concerned with the possibility of Bruton error because some of the defendants had made statements against some of the other defendants, and it did not appear that any of the defendants were going to testify. But in Mr. Talton's case, there was insufficient evidence of venue because the only evidence in that case was Agent Watson's testimony that...
You're talking about venue now, right?
Yes, I am.
Right.
Not challenging the evidence on any other elements of the case.
But you have to argue plain error, don't you?
Unfortunately, I have to argue ineffective assistance with respect to venue because of the law being that it's actually a waiver when venue is not specifically mentioned in the Rule 29 motion. And in this case, it wasn't. Counsel made a motion for dismissal of the indictment pretrial based on lack of venue, and that was denied. And, you know, I'm not challenging that because the indictment did allege that the conspiracy took place in both Missouri and the Southern District of Illinois. But the proof at trial didn't match that allegation.
What was missing?
There was no proof of any acts in the Southern District of Illinois. There was plenty of proof in the Eastern District of Missouri, even the Western District of Missouri, and in Kansas. But the only thing with regard to the Southern District of Illinois was that Agent Watson's testimony that Mr. Bohanna went over to St. Louis and bought cocaine from Mr. Stevenson, and there was no evidence of fronting in Talton's case.
That would have been possibly hearsay anyway, wouldn't it?
It would have been, which is why I also raised the confrontation argument separately, arguing that Agent Watson's testimony violated Mr. Talton's right to confrontation because Mr. Bohanna did not testify.
But the agent testified, but he didn't say anything about fronting.
No, he did not.
Do you think we should address this ineffectiveness issue at this point or wait until there's a collateral proceeding?
This is one of the rare cases where it should be addressed on direct appeal because there is sufficient evidence to show. There's no reason why counsel did not raise it other than possibly he thought that his general motion covered everything and simply was mistaken about the need to specifically argue venue as part of his Rule 29 motion, even though he'd argued it previously. And as the cases of Ms. Wilkins and Mr. Moore show, there's obviously prejudice. They've now been acquitted based on the exact same argument because their attorneys raised the issue below. And in the alternative, of course, even if this court were to find sufficient evidence, this court would reverse based on the
conference. This may have been strategic. What's your view on that?
There does not appear to be any possible strategic reason. There was no evidence in the record to show venue. We have the same evidence. Apparently, I mean, obviously I didn't read the whole transcripts in Wilkins and Moore, but from the government's description in their brief, in this evidence is basically the same in both of those cases, and they obviously made the motion for the same reasons. There was nothing to lose by making the motion. The worst that could happen would be denied.
Unless they were confident of an acquittal on the merits, because if they're just if it's just improper venue, they could be retried. I mean, I realize the government isn't retrying Wilkins and Hogan, but they could. So there's a little.
That seems unlikely, given the strength of the evidence, that there would be that level of confidence in acquittal. I mean, a hope for one, of course, but there's always that. But I can't imagine too many defense attorneys being that confident in an acquittal, given the on the merits, given the strength of the evidence in this case. I'm certainly not conceding.
Right.
Guilt because in the event of a retrial, but you're not going to challenge it on appeal either.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Emanuelson?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Emanuelson, and I am here representing another appellant in this case, Gregory Hogan. My argument this morning will be limited to the question of whether the district court's refusal to allow Mr. Hogan to inform the jury that its verdict would result in a mandatory life sentence without parole violated Mr. Hogan's Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. On the issues of improper hearsay and venue, we will stand on our briefs and the arguments of co-appellant Talton, which we join. Greg Hogan.
He's a real loser, right? And you're saying the jury has to know what the sentence is so it can nullify, right? What are the purposes? What are the purposes there to tell the jury what the sentence is?
Your Honor,
it's nothing to do with guilt.
The purpose is so that the jury can exercise.
The jury can nullify because the sentence is totally irrelevant to the issue of guilt. Jury is supposed to decide whether the person is guilty. The only thing it can do with evidence of the punishment is decide, oh, we think he's guilty, but we think the punishment is too great. Or we think he's innocent, but the punishment is too light, so we're going to convict him.
Your Honor, that is definitely the prevailing view of the function
What's
of juries.
View, right? What's the matter with it?
It's not the view at common law that
was... Oh, forget the common law. Look, what's the sense of it? Is there any purpose other than nullification served by telling the jury what the punishment is?
The purpose is that three strikes to life sentences without parole have
so
a
your
special...
The answer is no. It's just nullification. It's just the jury may decide this is an excessively severe sentence.
It is nullification. Yes.
Right. Well, but there isn't any right to nullify. It's a power, but there's no right. So a lawyer isn't allowed to tell a jury, look, my defendant may be guilty, but this is an unjust system and so on, so I'd like you to acquit him. That's misconduct.
It is not a direct instruction on nullification. It is providing the jury
be realistic. There's no other function except to facilitate jury nullification, because the jury isn't asked what the punishment should be. It's just asked guilt or innocence, guilt or not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That is correct, that is the function, Your Honor. I am not arguing that that is not the function. However, in the Jones case, which relied on the historical jury function at the time that the Sixth Amendment was drafted, it took into account not just the jury's fact-finding powers.
Over the last 200 years, no one realized that?
Your Honor, there has been a lot of decisions since that time, of course. But the Jones, Apprendi, Booker, Blakely line of cases took an originalist interpretation of the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. That does not comport with modern jurisprudence, of course. But there is a foundation for the jury to perform this additional function of mitigating unreasonably harsh sentences. And that is founded in the history which the Supreme Court has accepted.
No, but you're not talking about mitigation. You're talking about nullification.
I'm not saying
the jury can impose a lighter sentence. All it can do is acquit.
Well, the way the drug laws are set up, Your Honor, there actually is mitigation because the government asked for a special verdict of that the drug quantity was over 50 grams. If the jury had found that the drug quantity was under 50 grams, it would have been a 10-year sentence. The difference between one gram.
You want the jury to lie about the way the 18th century juries nullified death penalties for larceny? If that's what you're asking?
Your Honor, I do not see it as lying. I see it as the jury using.
It's lying. If the jury believes that it's more than 50 kilograms and returns a special verdict of 49, it's lying.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. The jury issuing a verdict, as it did in common law, that mitigates punishment, can be more than a lie. And in three strikes to life mandatory minimum sentences without parole, that lie, as you call it, performs an important function and check on the government for excessively severe sentences.
What's your issue on venue?
Your Honor, my issue is, I see my time's run out.
I want to hear it.
Great. The issue is that in our supplemental brief, we argue that Mr. Hogan did not waive his right to challenge venue because his co-defendant in the case, Jennifer Wilkins, had made that objection. And under some reasoning in other circuits, the venue waiver should not be readily inferred in circumstances like this.
Now, the government confessed error in her case.
Correct. So
now, what's the difference in your case?
There's no difference. The confession
why wasn't
of error.
It, why wasn't it? Why didn't they go forward with it? Just because they figured if the judge denies her, he's going to deny you, or what? You weren't there. I know.
I'm not there, and that's why we argue in the alternative ineffective assistance of counsel and join the argument of co-appellant Talton.
Well, the other guy's Moore got 360 months, and he's off the hook. Your guy gets life. Nobody made the argument.
Nobody made the argument, Your Honor.
Is that waiver?
We argue that it's not, because it would have been a futile argument because
okay,
the code...
You're arguing futility, then?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Emanuelson.
You also raised this point of background testimony. Can you say something about that when you do your
oh, class? Sure.
You don't have to do it right now, but you'll be coming back.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Liggins.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Liggins, and I represent the United States in this case. I will take.
So, why did you put in all that marijuana evidence?
Well, as your colleagues have pointed out, it was part of the cocaine transactions. I mean, I know that this court.
Well, what does that mean?
Disfavors the inextricably intertwined.
Oh, please! What do you mean favors it?
I said disfavors it.
I'm sorry, I misheard.
But it was part of the cocaine transactions, and it also goes to the.
Well, so what? It was so what?
Well, it would go to the the knowledge and intent of the parties.
Well, I don't understand. Why does selling marijuana relate to the knowledge that he's selling cocaine?
It goes more to the intent of
what?
Of the intent of.
I don't understand. He's selling crack. What more do you need in the way of intent?
What if
he's selling crack and he's also selling helium balloons? Would you say that went to his intent?
No, Judge, I wouldn't say that would go to his intent to distribute narcotics. But the fact that they were dealing in other drugs goes.
Well, that's irrelevant, right? Because you didn't charge him with it. You could charge him with a marijuana offense. You didn't charge him with a marijuana offense.
I guess my best answer is that it shows that the parties had an ongoing.
That's a very bad answer. This is misconduct by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Well, Judge, I don't think there is.
Other bad acts, you're supposed to make, you know, a 404B tender. You don't do that. You just throw it in. It has nothing to do with the crack cocaine. It's improper, unnecessary, and sanctionable.
Well, Judge, in any event, I think.
Well, don't do it again.
Well, Judge, I actually wasn't the trial counsel below.
Well, I don't care. You're part of that office.
So tell
them not to do it, right? It's improper.
I will tell them not to do that, Judge. But getting to the further issue, I believe the court's analysis is correct that in the context of this case, it's harmless error.
Would you talk about the venue issue? You've confessed error on two of them. And
yes.
They're out. Varying degrees of challenging, some none, some a little bit, some not enough, whatever. What's going on here? I really worry about this. Here's the guy, Stevenson's done for life. Hogan gets life, and there's some question about venue, but he was tried with Wilkins, right? Hogan and Wilkins?
Yes.
Yeah, and Wilkins gets off, and Hogan didn't make the motions. He should have had exactly the same result if it had been properly argued, I guess. Is that correct?
Yes.
If they'd argued that, you would have the same objections that are made, you'd confess error per Hogan.
That's... If he would have raised it in the manner that Wilkins did, yes. If
he's standing right there, and I don't know what, but whatever the reason, we got nobody here that tried this case, I see. But that's
the correct. And I believe that really goes to the where the record is silent. You don't presume that the defense counsel. You don't presume what his motives were for raising it or not raising it.
And what motive could he have?
I don't know, Judge.
Just a mistake.
That's more than likely what it's going to be.
Right.
And if that's what it is, we're gonna be willing to confess error if that's what it is. But
why don't you do it now and then save us a 2255? I don't understand.
Because the record is silent. And
so what? You know what the situation is.
But you can't presume.
Why not?
Give me
a reason why it can't be presumed.
This court's decision in United States versus Traeger and that whole line of cases. And we are.
Why don't you just confess error?
Because we don't have a sufficient record on those individuals to do it at this
point.
But
you just said you don't have any, there's no motive, there's no strategic motive here.
I don't know that that's the case.
What would the strategic motive be?
I don't know. But, you know, you can't presume what it is. All we need to know is what the defense...
What a waste of time.
You're from the defense counsel.
Ridiculous waste of time. Why did you promise, was it Wilkins, that you're not going to try him again?
I don't know why that promise was made, Judge. I don't know why that promise was
made.
Why
don't you know that?
That promise.
I mean, it makes your position with regard to Talton seem even more ridiculous than it is. Because here you're saying to these people, you could retry them. It's a procedural error. So you said, no, you walk.
Yes.
We're never going to try you. So it creates this, you know, kind of preposterous disparity in punishment between identically situated people. Oh, pointless. Why do you want to keep this circus going?
Well, actually,
you know how it's going to end up.
We would still like to have a sufficient record on.
Why do you want a sufficient record? I don't understand this.
Because we don't know why they did what they did.
Wasting taxpayers' money.
But we don't know why they did what they did.
You're saying the defense attorney has to testify why he stood there while the other person made all the objections that has got its client off the hook.
Yes.
And he's got to come up with what? What is strategic reason for not doing anything?
Or that it was had nothing to do with.
Or is this another futility argument?
Where
it wouldn't do any good to argue it because the court denied it for the other person? Is there anybody in your office who was there who tried this case?
Yes.
Did you ever talk to them?
Yes.
I know that it's hearsay. What went on? What's the problem?
I don't know.
I look at this and they confess error for one and the other gets life in prison because he didn't say anything.
Well, I do know the answer to that. The reason the decision to confess error is not one that is ultimately made by our office. It's made by the Solicitor General's office. And they were concerned about the Fifth Circus case in Strain, which said when you raise this on direct appeal or when you preserve the issue, then a judgment of acquittal is the proper remedy. And that is that case.
That is not the law, and that is not what the Justice Department believes.
That's what I was told, and it is primarily the concern about the Strain case.
All that Fifth Circuit case says, well, maybe acquittal would be appropriate. Didn't say it's required.
Right.
And all the other cases go the other way and say it's a procedural error and you can have a retrial. Why doesn't the office send the person who was involved in the case?
He was in trial, Judge. And so I drew the short straw.
He knows what's going on.
Was this Bohanna's statement, was that evidence in Talton's trial or in all of these people's trials?
Bohannon only testified in Stevenson's trial.
Stevenson's?
Yes.
And everybody else is the agent. It was basically hearsay.
Correct.
Bohannon told the agent.
Correct.
Well, I mean, the agent, where did the agent testify?
Excuse
me? Which trial did the agent testify?
All the ones except Stevenson.
And then you had Bohannon himself.
Yes.
Well, why didn't Bohannon testify about the venue issue rather than the agent?
Because the attorney trying the case was under the misapprehension that he didn't have to.
The person in your office?
Yes.
Another mistake?
Yes.
But that was the whole link. It's like plugging in a light in one room and lighting up in the other. The only plug was Bohannon. And he had to say that it was fronted, and he did. He only said it in one case, and that was it. There's no other evidence of fronting, which is the only connection to the conspiracy, right?
Him being fronted by Stevenson.
Yeah.
And, yes, but, I mean, the...
That was a necessary ingredient. That one question, did you get... Whatever the question was that he asked him, Stevens not challenging it. He's there for life. He's convicted.
Yes.
He had the one person, Bohannon, testified in his, and not in all the rest of these, which were subsequent. Did everybody come up with this at the end of all this, that there was a venue problem? Didn't know in the... Talton seemed to be worried about it.
Talton was worried about it pre-trial.
Yeah.
But then didn't raise it.
And the judge didn't grant it. I don't know what the judge did. The judge must have known that... The judge heard all five of these cases, right?
Yes.
Okay. So he's heard Bohannon testify in the first case.
Yes, he did.
And nobody, you know, there's a connection. He got fronted, so he's part of the conspiracy, and therefore there's venue in Illinois. But no, whatever the U.S. attorney, I don't know whether the judge, he's not supposed to inquire about where's your other witness. I don't know. It just seems weird that this whole thing proceeded through without the key witness, person that had to testify in order to make this conspiracy connect Illinois.
I agree, Judge. All I can tell you is that it was I don't want to lay it all at the hands of the AUSA who was handling the case. There was also some supervisory.
Great screw up in your office. So why don't you just clean it up? Why don't you come up here and embarrass the Justice Department with?
Well, Judge,
you could have taken care of it so easily.
I'm still falling back that, for the record, is silent regarding the defense counsel's motivations.
2255. Will it be more embarrassment for the Justice Department?
I expect that if there is. Once they say there was no good strategic reason, then that will be the end of the case. But I think we are entitled to have that.
Because
we don't know why they did it.
You think he's going to get up and say, the lawyer's going to say he made a mistake, right? There isn't any strategic reason.
I don't know what was in his mind.
I don't understand. You practice. Don't you know what kind of strategic reasons defense lawyers have for various decisions they make?
Sure.
So you should be able to speculate and at least imagine whether there might be a reason. Apparently you have thought about it and you can't think of a reason. Why wouldn't that be enough to say no reason?
Well, Judge, again,
it's a waste of time, waste of our time, waste of your time. You know exactly how it's going to come out.
Well, you know,
an opinion criticizing you, so I don't mean personally, but the office.
All you know, it is somebody else's decision that Bohannon wasn't necessary for the other trials.
I don't know that there was. He wasn't necessary. There was
You said the person who tried this case is in trial somewhere, right?
He was in trial. He couldn't travel up here.
He couldn't do this appeal.
Right.
Yeah. But you talked to him.
Yes.
And did you ask him? Other than did he say why he didn't call Bohannon? I thought, you know, I looked at this. I thought, well, Hannah must have done something, you know, his lawyer told him not to testify anymore or something, or wanted a better deal. I don't know why he didn't. But if he was available to testify and wasn't called when he's the key link, somebody had a reason. Maybe it wasn't a good reason.
It was a misapprehension, again.
He thought that the agent's testimony was enough.
Yes.
Even when the agent didn't even testify, there was fronting.
I believe the belief on that was that once you have an overt act occurring in the Southern District of Illinois, and you have
you don't have to prove it in each trial, huh?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all, Judge. What I'm saying is that I don't know that you have to I don't know that you have to prove fronting in the Southern District of Illinois in each trial, as long as you establish an overt act occurring in the Southern District of Illinois, and that individual was part of the conspiracy.
Well, yeah, he's not part. If it's just a mere sale, he's not necessarily part of the conspiracy. If he's fronting, obviously he's in on it.
Yes, but the.
Look, I don't want to press you anymore. Look, this is unfortunate. That's all I can say.
Can you make a very short argument on your background testimony issue?
Yes, that is.
Because I think this case comes pretty close to the edge on that.
The And I agree. Our best argument on that is harmless error in light of Silva and in light of Crawford.
Because you got a confidential informant here, and we've got cases saying that it may be different if you got a confidential informant that's being, you know, whose testimony is being, or whose comments are being related in this background business. So I think this case is pretty close to the improper in that area, but you're saying, sort of conceding that it probably is, but it's harmless.
I think I can predict what this court's ruling is going to be on that issue. Our best argument is that it's harmless. My time is up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Likens. Anything further from the defendant's lawyers? Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were all appointed or member of the defender's office, and we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the defense. Next case.